she turns her back to the audience and starts doing a dance step that moves upstage, and she has a sign attached to her backside that says "For Whites Only." One of her dancers had stolen it from a segregated train car when they were taking the train down to Kentucky. And so the sign is swinging back and forth as she's dancing upstage for the audience to see. And then she comes out and reads a speech and said, "I'm glad you've enjoyed this show, but I will not return to Louisville until people like me can sit next to people like you."
That's historian and dance professor Joanna D. Doss. She's discussing Katherine Dunham, a legendary African-American dancer and activist. Dunham lived in East St. Louis and partnered with the Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville to further her dance program. I'm Willis Ryder Arnold.
And I'm Nancy Fowler. And this is Cut and Paste. And joining us with Doss is Keith Williams, who is a Master Dunham teacher and a dance professional here in St. Louis, who works with young people and uses Katherine Dunham's choreography to bring forward her work to a new generation. Yeah. Doss and Williams talked about just how relevant Dunham's activism is in today's current climate and the ways in which she really was a woman before her time.
Her life spanned almost the entirety of the 20th century. She was born in 1909 and died in 2006. And she's really important to the history of the 20th century for multiple reasons. First, she's probably most famous for having the first, what many people consider the first black dance company in the United States. Of course, black choreographers came before her, but hers was the first company that was very widely recognized. And she's also very well known for her work in arts education. She founded multiple dance schools and founded her own dance technique, the Dunham Technique. And what I'm interested in also is how all of her work in the arts also contributed to social and political change, particularly the Black freedom struggle in the 20th century, which is the name that historians now give to the civil rights movement to show how it was longer than just the 1950s and 1960s, how this Black freedom struggle has been going on for many, many decades. And Dunham was a part of it from the 1920s through to the end of her life.
So how did you actually first become acquainted with her as this figure of history? And how did you end up deciding to write a book about her?
Well, I actually grew up in St. Louis, and I trained at the Center of Creative Arts, COCA, under Lee Nolting. And in Lee Nolting's jazz class, not only were the movements we did inspired and influenced by Dunham, but also Lee Nolting's approach to dance education and the philosophy that the arts are a way to build community and create social change. Then when I came back to thinking about Dunham in graduate school, I was just really interested in this questions about artists as agents of social change. And I thought, oh, well, Dunham was someone who really was an activist through the arts. And I started talking to Lee again and to my very first Dunham teacher, the late Daryl Braddix. And so I decided to write about her in the context of a history PhD program. And I started becoming involved in the Dunham Technique seminars again, starting in 2010. And so for the past 7 years, I've become involved in the Katherine Dunham Centers for Arts and Humanities and the Institute for Dunham Technique Certification.
Keith, how did you first encounter Katherine Dunham?
My first encounter actually was after I transferred from University of Illinois in Champaign, Urbana. I'd started delving into the arts, taking a few voice lessons and dance classes, and I came home for a weekend. I went down and took a class with Archie Savage, which was Miss Dunham's first partner, and the class was just mind-boggling, spiritually changing for me. There must have been at least six drummers in there, and so the spirit was just contagious. And it just ministered to my spirit in terms of, just spoke to my spirit in terms of my art and the creative outlet, the subject matter, the rhythm, the history. And I initially went back to U of I and went to my mom and said, "I want to transfer." And from there, I was just entrenched into the whole Dunham experience, the Dunham legacy.
And what year would this have been? What period would this have been for you?
I was only 16, no. It was actually 1977, I think is when I transferred. And I moved to New York in 1980.
So Katherine Dunham was very well into her career at this point. What sort of social activism work had she done?
One of Dunham's biggest contributions was putting forward Afro-Caribbean dance on the concert dance stage and saying, this is also art. This is a valid art form. And so challenging certain ideas about what counted as high art or not, mm-hmm. right? So that itself is an activist move on her part. She also sometimes did choreograph pieces specifically about social justice issues. This was not the majority of her dances, but there were specific moments in her career where she decided to take a stand choreographically, such as her anti-lynching dance drama, Southland. Mm-hmm. First premiered in 1950 in Chile. Offstage, she was also a celebrity, and nowadays we don't know too many dancers who are celebrities, but Dunham was a celebrity in her time, and she used that platform to speak out against segregation and discrimination. She threatened to sue the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago when they refused to house her company, and this was international. She was an international figure.
And just the simple fact that she chose East St. Louis as a place to invest in and create, settle and create roots, that she would choose an impoverished city, which I was born and raised in, to create this school that really concentrated not only just on art, but on academics. And she found within the power that arts could have to impact the social environment, you know, the cultural disparities that existed in East St. Louis. But she felt that there was a wealth there that was embedded in the community and the culture of East St. Louis, despite the negative perspectives that many people have had of East St. Louis. Ms. Dunham saw a great potential. And the fact, I think that's a major social justice move, that mm-hmm. she could be this world famous person, could have chosen Paris, could have chosen Finland, could have chosen New York, could have chosen L.A., whatever, but she chose East St. Louis to settle her roots, and she has impacted many of our lives. The baton, so to speak, have been passed on from her to her major and company members and then to us. So then now we have the voice and the opportunity to speak on social justice and have our art impact communities.
As Keith is pointing to, one of the changes Dunham made to the field of dance is talking about the meaning behind dance movements, right? That there's deep spiritual meaning, there's deep social meaning, there's deep individual meaning. And so dance was not just some kind of side project you did in your life. It was a part of a holistic, cohesive life. Learning how to use your body to communicate with others and to understand yourself was a huge piece of how she taught dance to others through her many schools and through what she put on stage. And it was tremendously influential.
Yeah, and I think that part, that it speaks to Miss Dunham's vision beyond the physical aesthetic of dance, that she felt that you'd have to develop the whole person. And that is body, mind, and spirit. And I think that's one of the distinct things in terms of looking at Dunham, the technique. It's just not a physical technique. Ms. Dunham believed that we have to develop ourselves as caring, compassionate human beings while embracing our power. But that doesn't stop and finish in our class. We take ourselves off into the world, and it's her hope that through our art, through the way in which the whole person is being developed, that we make positive deposits in our community and the global society. So it's developing that whole individual. It's not just about doing that step on the stage. And I think that is one of the distinct differences between most other techniques.
So is that part of the type of activism work that she did?
Most definitely. The whole focus that, as I was saying, that developing the whole entire person, that you must know self first. You must be aware of self, aware of your power, and as well be aware of the purpose and intention of why you dance. I mean, she's very much into educating us on the dances that come from the African diaspora, whether it be Brazil, whether it be Cuba, whether it be Jamaica, and even in terms of the classical forms, in terms of, like, we had to take ballet class every day, you know. We had to take history. And so while developing that entire human being, then you're actually creating a very well-informed individual, you know, that can really speak beyond the physical demonstration of the step.
And yeah. it was remarkable that this idea is for everybody, and also specifically to help. She wanted to help her students who were of African descent, right? Mm-hmm. That I'm going to paraphrase her here, but she wrote in a letter in 1946 to her friend Edwin Enbury, who was part of the Rosenwald Foundation, that and she said, you know, until minority groups can learn to see themselves as part of a global culture and see their place in the world and not just... You know, there are education systems in the United States, especially in the 1940s, and you could argue still today, sort of placed African Americans as part of an oppressed minority. And she said, my sort of system of education teaches them to see themselves as part of a global majority of people of color. And that allows them to kind of go out in the world with, you know, with strength. And so there's a way in which this form of education is very empowering to all human beings, but also specifically for her African-American students in the U.S.
So we have an audio clip of Dunham not too long before her death talking about a decision that she had to make early in her life.
And I think that's when I decided this is what I want to do. I will not give up anthropology. Two of them came together in my own thoughts about form and function and dance anthropology and so forth. And meeting of arts and science, very, very important to me. And I'm glad to have been one of the forerunners of that.
I think it speaks to what Keith and I were discussing before about how dance is not just an isolated part of the human experience, that when she went on her anthropological research trips to the Caribbean in 1935, she discovered that dance was fully integrated into the lives of the people she mm-hmm. Was living with, right? They danced at births, funerals, weddings,
harvest,
mm-hmm. et cetera. And so anthropology helped her see dance as a part of this whole human being.
And I think it's very much connected to our history, and particularly in most indigenous cultures. When you think about it, dance is an integral part of celebration. Like she was saying, they mm-hmm. celebrate death, they celebrate marriage, life, and it goes into in terms of form and function, a purpose as to why you're dancing. And I think that challenge, that education, that awareness for a dancer gives you so much more power in terms of understanding what you're doing and why. Because otherwise, I think the energy and the spirit in which it gives to the audience is that it's just merely a physical step. But if you can embody I think Ms. Dunham dealt with many of us in terms of very truthful storytellers. And if you know what the purpose of the dances are, and then you know you can embody that and you can authentically tell that story and convey that story, because sometimes we don't have the narrative of giving voice. We're not saying this is what it is. We're demonstrating through our movement the process in which Ms. Dunham dealt with us as individuals to bring her work to life was very complex. It's very complex, but much needed, because I think many times we see some dancers who can execute steps and they're merely steps, and that's okay. Some things are very abstract. Mm-hmm. And so that whole purpose of why are you dancing? Okay, you're doing this dance from Rita Passage, the rite of moving from your childhood through your adolescence to adulthood. There's a reason why you do this step. I do a thing in a piece called The Ties That Bind. It's about the Underground Railroad, and you know, and the slaves are escaping. And I took them through the thing where they're like covering their tracks. They're covering their tracks, and they say to Harry Tubman, they would put cayenne pepper to deter the dogs from sniffing the pathways. That's form and function. And when I invest and challenge my dancers to understand what the context of what's happening and why they're moving, why did they use the pepper, why did they cover the tracks, why did they go in circular patterns, why did they go through the water and do the cayenne pepper, that's form and function.
Sure, and also that there doesn't have to be a division between functionalism and high art. You know, mm-hmm. and this is a debate that happens in other artistic forms, right? You know, can a tea kettle be functional and a work of art at the same time? And Dunham believed yes, right? Dance can have functional meaning and purpose, but that doesn't mean it's utilitarian or unartistic. So, you know, Keith's work, for example, is taking this idea of having meaning and purpose and building a piece of art out of it. Right? And so it doesn't have to stay in the realm of literal function and meaning, mm-hmm. but be inspired by kind of the reasons you might internally be motivated to do something. And while you might not catch 100% of the literal meaning of what's happening on stage, that a more genuine expression, artistic expression, comes out of an artist when that artist knows why he or she is doing it. And even if the audience doesn't understand exactly, they believe the artist knows, right? So you don't have to exactly know that there's cayenne pepper on the ground, but you know that that dancer is doing this movement for a purpose, and that's what's coming across to you.
The authenticity of the experience just mm-hmm. really comes through mm-hmm. if it's based on something real and felt.
Mm-hmm. And the question of authenticity can sometimes be a little tricky because Dunham at one point said, I'm so tired of everyone asking me if my dances are authentic. Because you always have to translate, you know, if you see someone doing a social dance that they do for 3 hours in a row in a nightclub in Jamaica, you're going to translate that into a 10-minute dance on stage. So you're going to have to change things. So it's not about reproducing exact steps authentically, but about taking the spirit and intention of those movements and making an honest gesture towards them and sort of honoring and respecting where those steps come from. Mm-hmm. And it can be tricky. It's not a black and white issue. And, you know, I don't know why I keep thinking of Beyonce recently, but, you know, some people criticized her for her use of invocation of New Orleans in her recent music video Formation because she isn't from New Orleans, even though her family is originally from New Orleans. But then other people said, no, that is a experience that she feels like she wants to talk about and she has a right to kind of invoke New Orleans dance steps and New Orleans culture. So this question of authenticity isn't always 100% clear cut. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix
that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama. And I think bringing up Beyonce is really interesting here because, as you'd mentioned earlier, Katharine Dunham also used her celebrity to kind of address the issues that she saw. At one point, she refused to participate or to perform in segregated dance halls where she was using her dance celebrity status not to actually engage in those racist structures that already existed.
Which was quite bold and quite courageous at that given time. This is before the 50s, 60s of civil rights, 1944, I believe, mm-hmm. in Louisville, Kentucky. You'd have to have an extreme faith in your company to be steadfast in your beliefs. You would have to be a risk taker to say that, because as well as she has a company, it's also a business and the company needs to make money. So she would forego the possibility of having future options to make money for a company by standing before an audience saying, until people who look like me can sit next to people like you, we will not be returning. And I can understand, I'm paraphrasing, I can tell that you've enjoyed us. Mm-hmm. That's power. In 1944, that's power. That's bold. That's courageous. And I think that it's those shoulders, and I always say I sit at the feet and stand on the shoulders of my ancestors who worked hard, fought, and died that I might have a better life. And that's what I give homage and honor to Ms. Dunham for having that courage mm-hmm. at that particular time. That was way before its time to come out and do things mm-hmm. like that publicly.
I wanted somebody to explain in a quick way what happened in Louisville.
Sure. So in Louisville, Kentucky, Dunham was backstage getting ready for the show, and someone came to tell her that the theater was segregated. And she had asked her manager, Saul Hurock, her impresario, not to book her in any segregated venues. So she called the house manager to her office or her dressing room and said, no, please let in these African-American patrons who want to come see the show. There are empty seats in the white section. The black section is full. It's overflowing. And he threatened to call the police if she did not go on with her performance and fulfill her contract. So she did this very smart thing. As Keith was saying, these artists have to make these really difficult decisions. She still has to make a living, right? She can't get arrested. Her company members need to get paid. So she does the performance. She goes on with the performance. But at the end, she comes out stage to take a bow. She bows. She turns her back to the audience and starts doing a dance step that moves upstage. And she has a sign attached to her backside that says "For Whites Only." One of her dancers had stolen it from a segregated train car when they were taking the train down to Kentucky. And so the sign is swinging back and forth as she's dancing upstage for the audience to see. And then she comes out and reads a speech and said, "I'm glad you've enjoyed this show, but I will not return to Louisville until people like me can sit next to people like you." You know, I'm one of a number of historians who are starting to address this absence in the sort of history we have of the civil rights movement. It often seems like the way it's told in high school textbooks that it began, fights against segregated spaces begin with Rosa Parks on December 1st, 1955. And the historian Martha Biondi has called African American artists the, quote, unsung heroes of the earlier civil rights movement. Because as Keith said, Dunham's protest against segregation in Louisville, Kentucky happened in 1944. And her lawsuit against the Blackstone Theater, also 1944. She is also exposing the lie that segregation only happens in the South, not the North. I mean, Louisville's in the South, but for example, in 1943, the year before, was the year of her big opening on Broadway, her show Tropical Review, and she could not get hotel rooms for her company in Midtown Manhattan. Everyone kept referring her to this hotel in Harlem and saying, "Oh, our rooms are booked. Why don't you go up to the hotel in Harlem?" And she spoke out about it in the newspapers, and people wrote her letters from all over the country. So I think scholars are starting to recognize that more, and I'm hoping that my book on Dunham helps really bring her role in this earlier sort of phase of the civil rights movement more to light.
Yeah, and to hopefully with that and other, with your book, I'm hoping that younger artists, while they aspire to achieve their success in their chosen fields, that they would then learn about people like Ms. Dunham, so they would know the people who really paved the way. It's so important, because I think that's a disconnect in our history, mm-hmm. when we don't really recognize. We receive the benefits of being able to do all that we do, go to any hotel that we want to perform in. I performed all on Broadway and London, Queen of England, and all that. That just wasn't on my shoulders. So I think I'm hoping that younger people will then learn more about people like Katherine Dunham, who really, she was a trailblazer and really worked hard and laid a strong foundation for us to really carry on that legacy.
From the perspective of having just completed a book that is really about the intersection of dance and activism, like with this one person, what it's like to be putting out this book at this time from your perspective.
Yeah, I think a lot about Black Lives Matter as I'm writing this book, because I am 100% certain, and I'm sure Keith would agree, that Dunham would be very involved in the Black Lives Matter movement if she were alive today. And she would be emphatic about the need, as Keith has said, to have an international perspective on it, right? She would be talking about the Dominican Republic's attempt to kind of ethnically cleanse Haitians, for example. She would probably have something to say about the Syrian refugee crisis. Yeah. And I think about the Black Lives Matter movement a lot. And also, I'm mentioning Beyonce too much, but also about this evolution, right? How artists can grow and change. In 2012, Harry Belafonte called out Jay-Z and Beyonce for not being vocal enough about Trayvon Martin's death and how they were not responding and not using their position to speak out. And then in 2016, you have Formation, you have her performance at the Super Bowl, you have Kendrick Lamar's performance at the Grammys. Awesome. And then you have lots of artists on the ground. In Philadelphia, I was involved in an organization called Dancing for Justice, and we marched up Broad Street, the Avenue of the Arts, to protest against police brutality. And you have artists like Keith. So there's a new swelling of activism that was happening in the 1930s and 40s. You know, Dunham was part of a generation that really did. She and Harry Belafonte were peers, and other dancers like Pearl Primus, for example, were really a part of this swelling up of activism through the arts. And so There's a lot of connections between what she did in her life and her peers and what is happening today.
Catherine Dunham echoed her sentiment about activism in an interview toward the end of her life when she gave a message to African-American youth.
Well, I think those two words of patience and flexibility are very important, but I think also action is important. I think no longer can people think they can just sit down and let somebody else do it. I think that those young people coming along have to do, and they have to learn how to find themselves in doing.
And what about your students? What are they understanding about Catherine Dunham that's relevant to them today?
This is how I frame this whole thing out. I talk about Catherine Dunham first and her boldness and her courage in 1944 before that Louisville, Kentucky audience. And then I tie it into my experiences of the civil rights from the 70s. And then I tie it into the whole thing of Black Lives Matter and Ferguson and Trayvon to their experiences, because I believe that until young people need to realize that this is your struggle, but your struggle just didn't happen in a vacuum by itself. There were other struggles prior to that. And I think that's where the importance of, say, anthropology and history is so vitally important, that you can then connect the dots and to see how history has evolved and in some instances not evolved as much as we would like them to be from a humanitarian perspective. But I think empowering my students to understand the voice that they have during their current time, look at mine, look at Catherine Dunham's, and just look at that whole spectrum and just see how we are all really woven together, which goes me back to my big piece, which I've talked to you about before, is the ties that bind, that we are all bound together, and not just from an African-American perspective, mm-hmm. which I think comes back to Mrs. Dunham's whole thing of intercultural communication, mm-hmm. Ms. Dunham believing that the more that people from diverse cultures came together and connected, it provides healing for a global society that we live in.
That was choreographer Keith Tyrone Williams talking about Catherine Dunham, the legendary dancer and activist from East St. Louis, along with Joanna D. Doss, the author of a new book about Catherine Dunham's life. I'm Nancy Fowler.
And I'm Willis Ryder Arnold.
And this has been Cut and Paste,
a project of St. Louis Public Radio. The music you heard in our intro was created by local musician Eric Hall.
You can find Cut and Paste at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.